This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And be it fruits and veggies or ornamental flowers, this is the time of year that pests can quickly invade and damage your plants. So all that work that you put in can be wiped out in a short amount of time. Here with advice on controlling lawn and garden pests and to answer your other gardening questions are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, Community Garden Manager with the Turner Farm Community Garden Program Joshua Jones, and Assistant Professor in the Ohio State University Department of Entomology and Ohio State Extension Agent for Hamilton County Joe Boggs. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Joe, Sarah, and Joshua, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
It's great.
Thanks for having us.
So, Sarah, talk about what are some of the common garden pests that are out there that people have to contend with in our area?
Well, right now, the Japanese beetles are out and thriving, and they like anything and everything. So we're seeing them on our ornamental plants, from our roses to our vegetables. Of course, we have the aphids. Tons of them are out there. I just got news that the spittlebug is out.
A spittlebug.
So if it looks like somebody's been spitting all over your plants, it's actually caused by an insect. It's called the spittlebug. So they get on our trees and a lot of our ornamental plants. And of course the mosquitoes are out and other kind of lovely pests. But also we have our beneficial insects that are out and eating the damaging nuisant pests, like our ladybugs, our praying mantis. We just saw our first caterpillar of the monarch yesterday in our garden. So, all the good insects as well as, the bad insects are out there in our environment.
So what's a Japanese beetle look like? Is that the beetle with the really shiny green body, the metallic green body?
Yeah, I think it's really pretty.
Pretty but destructive.
Yeah, very destructive. I call them our natural pruners because they have chewing mouth parts and they like to chew. And they, like I said, they don't have a host-specific plant. They kind of have a wide range from they really like flowers. So they like our roses, and they really tend to be in clusters and tightly, forming, in the tightest part and notches of the flower bud as possible to protect themselves. So they're just eating away and chewing away and doing some damage.
So how do you know what's the damage look like? What do they leave behind, if anything?
So you'll see some chewing, slightly serrated margins of their feeding habit. So holes, they're not perfect circles. That could be something else or environmental, but these are kind of serrated edges around their feeding hole. And you probably should see them early in the morning. They're not as active. So in the morning, you should see them still clustered together right in those flower buds.
Aphids, undersides of leaves usually, isn't that where the damage is?
Absolutely, yeah. So they have sucking mouth parts. So when they are feeding, their needle-like mouth part kind of puts little dots in your plant, and they're sucking away plant nutrients, and they can cause chlorosis or that yellowing in the plant. So when I know that their feeding habits, when I'm scouting out in my garden, if I see some discoloration, I don't automatically assume I need to add fertilizer. I just need to scout, turn over some leaves, because a lot of insects, they know if you're spraying pesticide, organic or non-organic, it's going to be on the top of the foliage. So they've gotten really smart and figured out if you come on the underside of the leaf, they're protected. So absolutely, and personal note, I can't stand aphids. Snakes, I can take them all day. But one interesting thing, thousands of aphids at multiple life cycles a season, and they can morph from wing to wingless. It's really gross, just depending upon...
It sounds like it.
Yeah, just depending upon their food source. So if there's too many aphids in a population and they need to go to another area to get food, they will morph into get wings and fly on to another plant. So it's pretty gross. But right now, they're on our tomatoes a lot in our garden. But again, similar to that of Japanese beetles, they don't have... they have a wide host range of plants that they like to feed on.
Joe, what are some of the other pests that, say, you find in vegetable gardens in particular?
Well, you know, I had a run-in last night watering my tomato plants with a big caterpillar I'm always very surprised at how they can go unnoticed. Two species called tomato and tobacco hornworms. They're called hornworms because they have this very long kind of horn-like projection. They're sort of blue-green in color. And I know Sarah and Joshua will really relate to this. I mean, I only have two tomato plants, but I started seeing some missing leaves, and I realized, uh-oh, I think I know what's afoot here. And yet it took me quite a long time to just find the two caterpillars responsible. So the tomato and tobacco hornworms are showing up in vegetable gardens, and they can very quickly cause extensive damage unless discovered and dispatched. Now, it hasn't happened yet, but some of the listeners will probably be aware that when they see these caterpillars a little bit later in the season, they'll start seeing these white structures that are sprouting from the back of the caterpillars. Those are actually good guys. I was very, very happy that you asked Mark about some of the good insects that are occurring that was mentioned earlier. Those white structures are the cocoons of a parasitoid wasp that eventually kills these caterpillars. So when you start seeing tomato and tobacco hornworms that have these white cocoons sticking out of them, the best thing to do is just leave the caterpillars alone, because that spells the doom for another generation of caterpillars.
Okay. You know, it's interesting in talking about beneficial insects. Is it a good idea to maybe bring some of these into your garden yourself, Joshua? And
definitely. I mean, there's commercially viable beneficial insects that you can bring into your farm or your greenhouse if you have one. We've brought in ladybugs to deal with our aphid problem. They will eat thousands of aphids in hours. We've cleared up our problem within a day. My best advice is just to plant flowers and things that will attract these beneficial insects from, you know, other parts of your neighborhood.
Okay. What are some of the other beneficial insects?
Well, a great one is our mantis, our praying mantis, you know, and then the parasitic wasp. We have obviously some bees. Ants are also predatory insects. They'll eat eggs of aphids, for example. But they're kind of, I don't know, Joe, we can talk about aphids and ant relationship. It's kind of a very interesting, if we want to get into that weird insect world.
And Joe, you should see Sarah's eyes right now. She talks about aphids. They're just, she's like, ooh, aphids. Ugh.
I heard that earlier. I tell you, that's a, you know, it is interesting because Sarah, of course, is attached to the University of Kentucky. And I was really pleased Joshua mentioned something that we overlook quite a lot. There's a lot of attention right now, rightfully so, for preserving pollinators. And we tend to think of pollinators in terms of, you know, well, the big one, you know, is actually a non-native European honeybees. But we tend to forget that I mentioned that parasitoid wasp a while ago. The adult wasps that are parasitoids typically feed on nectar and pollen. And Dr. Dan Potter, for example, at the University of Kentucky, and his graduate students have done a lot of very good research demonstrating that planting a number of different types of flowering plants that provide pollen and nectar will, in fact, enhance beneficial insects and reduce pest populations. And, of course, you can enjoy the flowers.
Absolutely. Not only for our ornamental gardens and for our vegetables and fruit, but also for the turf. You know, there are a lot of insects that live below our feet when we're walking outside. So, you know, creating those different types of habitats will invite our good, quote unquote, insects and bugs into our landscape. And, you know, it's a whole ecosystem and they kind of take care of each other. So if we create that habitat, it will invite them in.
We will continue our conversation about gardening and we'll take your questions. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining us to talk about lawn and garden pests and answer your gardening questions, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, Community Garden Manager with the Turner Farm Community Garden Program, Joshua Jones, and Assistant Professor in the Ohio State University Department of Entomology and Ohio State Extension Agent for Hamilton County, Joe Boggs. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We got a question by email from Claire, who lives in Newport. And it's about a silver maple tree that she has. She says it has a hole in it about 5 inches wide. Thought it was a squirrel's nest at first, but she recently found sawdust-like material on the ground right below the hole. And she says there are ant-like insects crawling around the hole, and she thinks it may be carpenter ants. And the hole's been there for a while, but the sawdust-like material only recently appeared. And she said she also found it on the inside of the hole. So she's wondering who she can get in to figure out what she's dealing with here. And any particular recommendations you might have about it for that tree.
Yeah, Claire. So, and any other listeners out there with similar issues. So, based on looking at some pictures here, looks like that pruning wound never really healed. It looks like whomever pruned did not prune correctly, got into the collar of the tree. So those cells were unable to heal off, shut off that vascular part of that tree. So what happened is it just created this habitat for all kinds of creatures to thrive in. So, and with that said, there's probably some rotting going on in the tree. And if you're seeing some carpenter ants, that's not a good sign. Yes, they are predatory. They're probably feeding on other things, probably some sap as well, as the sugars are oozing out, but they're also, they like the dead part of trees. So, Campbell County has a certified arborist on staff, and he does home site consultations free of charge for all Campbell County residents. So just call our office, and we'll be in touch with that. Anytime you have questions, you know, contact your local extension office. If you think it is a carpenter ant, just if you can collect a few, send me a few pictures of those. At least we can identify that. Maybe it's something totally different. Maybe it's not. The tree's not rotting. But you definitely want to get that identified, because if there is any rotting going on, it could be a hazardous to your house, to your community. So you definitely want to be a good steward to your environment.
Yeah. And as far as that hole, I mean, that seems like that's just an ideal environment that the carpenter ants found.
For
this
sure.
And said, boy, this is a great place to live.
Yep. And other things, too. It could have been squirrels, birds nesting.
It's probably changed hands a few times.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Well. You know, one thing we want to be careful about, though, is not to close that hole up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes we have people, you know, putting concrete in and trying to, and as Sarah pointed out, carpenter ants feed on decaying wood. They don't feed on sound wood. And so, you know, if they close the wound up, that will just enhance the internal decay, not allowing water to evaporate. The other thing, though, Mark, that I would want to make sure listeners hear, and that is, you know, don't spray for these ants. That's something that's a common misconception. Carpenter ants are native insects. They're commonly found in trees. Anyone living, you know, with trees near at hand, they might be surprised at finding carpenter ants. It doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, as Sarah's pointing out, that they do feed on decaying wood, so we want to make sure the tree's structurally sound, but it doesn't necessarily mean there's a problem. If, though, they eliminate that colony, the person could be in trouble, because carpenter ants create satellite colonies. They have a queen in one location, then they have these other colonies that do not have queens. And if we happen to eliminate the queen, let's say this tree does have the queen, then those satellite colonies all create queens. And let's say, for example, you have carpenter ants that have found their way into your home. Don't panic. They're very slow at tunneling wood. They don't eat wood. They just tunnel it to live in. However, if you eliminate the queen, then you could end up with a queen in a colony in a home, and that's been well documented. So we don't recommend that people, you know, spray trees. It'll actually have little effect on the carpenter ants. And, of course, you know, we want to make sure that if people do apply insecticide, they're very much targeting what it is they need to control. And, in fact, they do need to control something and not just be spraying because, well, that's the only option they can think about.
Yep. So just get it identified. Call our office. And again, if you're in Campbell County, a certified arborist free of charge will come out and take a look at the site.
Yeah. And an arborist makes sense in this case, because there's more going on here than just the carpenter ants.
Most likely,
there's something going on
yeah.
with the tree probably. Mm-hmm. So 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And let's talk with Mike in Indiana. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I have a situation where I wanted to dress up the area out by my mailbox. I live near a mailbox is near a rural highway, and I wanted to get maybe the names of two or three salt tolerant shrubs that I could use for this purpose.
Well, is it full sun?
It doesn't have to be.
Okay. It is going to be very challenging, and I'm assuming a very small, tight space. You're probably going to look for something that might give you an interest of all year round. My first suggestion would be to look at some ornamental grasses. They're fairly drought tolerant. Most of if this area is a little wet feet, what we call it, stays a little moist, it could tolerate that. Creates wonderful habitat, has beautiful color all year round and interest. If you're looking for something, and there's all different sizes, colors, things like that, you're not going to get much luck with anything evergreen, I will say. Definitely want to avoid Alberta spruces, boxwoods, those types of evergreens. If you're looking something perennial, you definitely have a wider range, but they're going to die back in the colder spell. So you may also think about Nandina. The common name is Heavenly Bamboo. It is not a bamboo, but that's just the common name. But Nandina is the genus. So you may want to look into that. And that is a semi-evergreen, meaning that it will keep its foliage all year round once it's established. And in my opinion, it's very beautiful, changing colors, different sizes and cultivars as that as well. So I guess that's more than two that you asked. But I just want you to be aware that you know, think about not just evergreens. There are other ornamental plants, but you're a little, I guess, limited in that area. Any other suggestions?
The salt thing is tricky for me. That roadside salt is really detrimental to a lot of plants. I agree with you. I think the ornamental grasses will have the most vigor. And I almost want to say that the dying back aspect of a perennial might even help it out in the wintertime because the salt isn't getting thrown on all of the foliage since it's pretty much just rootstock at that point in time.
That's a good idea. And then maybe the kind of combination with some ornamental grasses and some perennials as it matures might set off some, you know, give it some balance and interest. So have any more questions? I hope we've answered all of them. Joe, do you have any other suggestions?
Yeah, some surprise suggestions, perhaps. Elderberry, for example, okay. Sambucus. We're going, you know, with a native. Very showy. I mean, I actually like elderberry, and you can get cultivars. Believe it or not, staghorn sumac. Now, you know, the downside is both staghorn sumac. You're out near the road with a mailbox. If you put the sumac there, you probably won't find the mailbox in a very short period of time. But you could stand it off. You could have it behind, and it's very salt tolerant. Believe it or not, rugosa roses are actually very salt tolerant, both in salt spray in terms of soils as well. And we overlook these rugosa roses in favor of hybrid teas, which are really a problem rose, in my opinion. And I mean, they're beautiful, but they can be really tricky. And, of course, you know, knockout roses have come on the scene, less salt tolerant. Rugosa have the added benefit that if you like to make rose hip tea, that's probably one of your best sources for that. So rugosa rose would actually be one I would consider out there. You can keep them trimmed back. You can treat them like a hedge, and they perform very well.
Again, 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join us, you can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joe, as far as controlling garden pests, how important is good soil to controlling?
Well, my colleagues there in the studio, I'm sure their eyes lit up too, because that's where it all starts. You know, if we're not starting with a good underpinning of soil, and I would have to really stress this idea, and I know both Joshua and Sarah know exactly what I'm going to say first. If you have a vegetable garden and you've never had the soil tested, you're just working against yourself. There are numerous places. In fact, I just updated our soil testing fact sheet for Ohio State University Extension along with some other authors. University of Kentucky has outstanding resources, Purdue as well. So all three states, you have this option. And contacting your local Extension office to learn more is a good place to start. But a soil test is exactly like a blood test for the soil. And just as your physician learns a lot whenever they have your blood tested to help guide what it is you should and shouldn't do, it's the same with garden soil. So that is the absolute first step. And frankly, after that, then we start having a conversation.
Absolutely. You want to build that soil, add organic matter. And a lot of times, you know, you're purchasing fertilizer, organic or synthetic, and it becomes a wasted, nutrient. And we have to be mindful of where that nutrient is going, which ultimately ends into our drinking water. So make sure that we are mindful of what we're putting down, either it be in our vegetable garden or in our lawn or around our trees. But absolutely, it starts with the soil. You can, you know, compost yourself, buy compost, bulk or in bag. You can even get your soil, your compost analyzed as well at the extension office. So definitely want to start. That is the backbone or the blood work of your soil.
I really like that analogy, the blood work. Sure. I think you have to start there. I totally agree.
513-419-7100, and let's talk with Russ in Northern Kentucky. Hi, Russ.
Hi there. I have a question about grape tomatoes.
Okay.
We grow them in a pot on the deck, and they do very well. However, this year, we have a bumper crop, but many of them have a very small black dot on the tomato themselves. And I'm curious as to what might be causing that and the best way to protect them from it.
Would this be on the bottom of the... go ahead, Joe.
I didn't mean to laugh in disrespect, but you guys couldn't hear me earlier, but I heard Sarah talking about the problem before we started. That's why I was chuckling, because I have a feeling, and Joshua, you're right on, and Sarah, I know you know what this is.
Yeah, we actually were... I kind of told them that I expected to get this question from at least one caller today. Is the black spot on the bottom of the tomato by chance?
Most likely, I would say so.
Okay. So it's most likely something called bottomed end rot, and I actually kind of brushed up on this subject. A lot of times, it's thought to be a deficiency in calcium, and then now they're actually starting to debate that, whether or not it is actually a deficiency in calcium. So first, I would say start with a soil test, just like Joe recommended, and anytime you have any sort of disease problems, or maybe what you might suspect to be a nutrient deficiency, test the soil, and that's a good place to start. If you do test the soil and you find out that you have a calcium deficiency, you can start by side dressing your plant with bone meal. It's a nice, quickly absorbed source of calcium. A lot of times, though, from my experience, if you take off those tomatoes, sometimes you have to sacrifice some of the first of the fruit. A little bit later in the season, the plant will start to correct itself. It has also been linked to possible water stress. So make sure that your plants are getting enough water. I always have a rain gauge in my garden to know how much Mother Nature is giving it. And if Mother Nature is not giving it enough, you know, we supplement with watering. And I always, with watering, I always recommend watering at the base of plants. That way you protect your foliage and just helps mitigate other diseases that will come along.
Like we were talking about before, you know, our soil is so very important, and that's where the nutrients are. So, yes, it is a calcium deficiency, but if we have inconsistency of watering, those roots can't absorb the nutrients that it needs. And so what ends up happening, it becomes symptomatic. And so we're seeing these symptoms, but really it's not a deficient, majority of the time, it's not a deficient of a nutrient. It's actually just inconsistency of watering, too much water, not enough water. So my best friends are my fingers, and I feel down into that soil and I see how wet or how dry it is. And in containers, you want to be mindful that you want to water thoroughly, making sure that it drains completely out. Always make sure that there are drainage holes. You know, ideal time is in the morning, water around that root zone, and you shouldn't, you know, it's still edible. It's not going to hurt you. You know, if you want to cut that off and then juice it or make a sauce, no problem at all.
Speaking of spots on plants, we got an email from a listener who wants to know if the little orange spots on the underside of a leaf are aphid eggs.
What aphid eggs are you know, they can be kind of, but don't you guys agree we almost need a little bit more information about that?
Yeah. It could be maybe harlequin bugs, because I know they look almost like sushi rolls. if you know what I mean, Joe. I don't know.
But I'm concerned because we have so many different types of leaf spot problems, and maybe it's partially because shifting from tomatoes, segueing over into little spots on the underside of leaves. If these are raised, if the harlequin plant bug, for example, yes, they do, and they're out there. The eggs are hatching right now, as a matter of fact. But it's one of those where a description really should have a picture associated with it for us to be able to diagnose it properly. There are a lot of different things that could line up with that description.
Some of our even fungal diseases kind of have a raised orangish tint spot to them. So, again, it may not even be an insect. It could be pathological as well.
Well, and that's what I was kind of thinking. If they said it was on a hawthorn, of course, we have the hawthorn, different hawthorn, cedar hawthorn diseases, two different hosts. And yes, they do make raised structures, but this is one thing, and again, all three of us work with this quite a lot. How do we help people in diagnostics? And just think about it. I mean, I'm not denigrating the person that called and, say, just give a brief description.
Right. The best advice would be to get a picture to somebody or have somebody actually come out and look at it.
Yeah. Really need to have a little bit more information.
Okay, we'll continue our conversation about gardening, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, here with advice on controlling lawn and garden pests. And to answer your other gardening questions, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, Community Garden Manager with the Turner Farm Community Garden Program Joshua Jones, and Assistant Professor in the Ohio State University Department of Entomology and Ohio State Extension Agent for Hamilton County Joe Boggs. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we got a comment on Facebook from Lee, who says she's had great success attracting beneficial insects as a way to fight garden pests. And she says she once found a wheel bug and placed it in her garden.
Yeah.
And she found out that toads actually like squash bugs. Okay. So what's a wheel bug? I'm not familiar with that one.
Nor am I. I'll have to give this to Joe.
Joe, you want to explain it? I can, yeah.
Yeah, wheel bugs are in a group of a very large family of insects called the Rejuvidae, and they collectively are called assassin bugs. And I love that name because it really says what they do. They have sucking mouth parts, and they use those mouth parts to inject enzymes into their prey to digest the prey, and then they suck out the juices, kind of have an insect slurpee. But wheel bugs are so named because they have on their back, it's actually on their thorax, this looks like half a cog wheel. And they are very big insects. Typically, they usually show up as adults fairly late in the season. They love to take out caterpillars and then this other caterpillar-like creature called a sawfly larvae. So they are extremely beneficial. I've never heard, but I applaud the idea of releasing one in your garden because they're ferocious predators.
You find it, you put it to good use.
Now, I will caution folks, though, that, beneficial insects very often have the equipment to bite because they are, if they're predators, they're going to bite something, just like lions and tigers and bears. So with wheel bugs, she was very brave if she handled it, but I would not, I wouldn't recommend anyone handle these. They are capable of delivering a very painful bite. Doesn't make them bad, any more than a lion, that if you slap them and they bit you would be considered bad. It would be that if you don't know that you're handling an insect that can deliver a painful bite, then that could be a surprise. But
so is it like a bee sting, Joe, or what would you compare it to?
Actually, the people that I've known that have gotten drilled by one of these, it's far worse than a bee sting because remember they're injecting enzymes that dissolve flesh, so you end up with a very painful wound, for quite some time. But again, you know, I don't want to, we talk about things like that, and I don't want to scare anyone. These don't fly in. They're not aggressive. They're not going to attack you or anything at all like that. I'm just saying, you know.
Just be careful.
Yes, be careful handling, and then just appreciate what they do.
Let's talk with Fred in Sharonville. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I've got a question a little off topic. It's about tree selection.
Actually, any gardening questions wide open today. Go right ahead, Fred.
Okay. I've got an area that's it's wide open, full sun, there's lots of room. I've planted a pin oak, but it's not doing well at all. It's a really heavy clay soil, and I'm assuming it's very alkaline. It has, I think from my research, it's like an iron chloresis, I think. It's not able to take the iron up. It's gotten real yellow leaves. So I'm looking for a replacement that's going to work better in the soil. Any suggestions for a large shade tree that won't be bothered by the Asian longhorn beetle, particularly maples?
Yeah, well, you always want to choose a plant for the site. So like we were discussing earlier, I don't know if you heard, Fred, but start with a soil test. So get that soil test as you identified. A lot of the pin oaks are, they're very sensitive to salt, and also they like acidic soil. And they can show that chlorotic iron deficiency. So a maple would do well in our native, slightly alkaline soils. But I suggest getting a soil test done first just to see exactly where you are. I have some of my personal favorites. Bur oaks are wonderful. And if you're planting more than one, you want to make sure you diversify your tree selection. My other personal favorite is a ginkgo that does well in urban settings, very pollution tolerant, salt tolerant, drought tolerant, very little to unknown insects and diseases. I can keep rambling on about ginkgo if you want me to. If it's a dry site, you know, you also have to figure out, is it dry? Is it wet area? Because if it, you know, can tolerate a little wet area, you may think about some of our oaks that can tolerate a little bit wet feet. Any other quick suggestions?
Actually, the only two trees I was thinking about, the ginkgo and the bur oak, would be my suggestion. I like the ginkgo as well. It's very common in the city. I think the city of Cincinnati probably has 300 of them planted downtown. And they seem to be pretty much impossible to kill.
Joe, any other good suggestions?
Well, I love what you said. I mean, the perfect lead-in, swamp white oak, has performed very well. That's the red oaks pin oaks are in the red oak group. As a rule, the red oaks don't quite do as well in our heavy clay soils as those oaks in the white oak group, such as bur oak, chinkapin, or swamp white oak. But I do want to go back, though, that there was a statement made that, you know, fear of planting a maple because of the Asian longhorn beetle. Now, the Asian longhorn beetle situation in Bethel, Ohio, I feel very certain, you know, will be contained. It has not been found outside, you know, the Bethel area. And I would not base plant selections. I wouldn't avoid planting a maple based on that, because the other reason, if it should be found further afield, it will be targeted to be eradicated. So it's a very different situation than emerald ash borer, which is too far widespread to be eradicated.
That's good to know, Joe.
Let's talk with Raja in Montgomery. Good afternoon. Go right ahead. Okay, we lost him. Our apologies. So let's talk with Mary in Lawrenceburg. Hi, Mary.
Hey, good afternoon, and of course, we're getting a little more rain now. So it's kind of tough on the plants.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of bugs we're battling. You know, we got bad soil, and now we got bugs. So is there anything that we could do to keep the mosquitoes down?
Yes.
Keep mosquitoes down?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I heard that marigolds will help you get rid of the mosquitoes on your back deck, let's say. Is that true?
That's a myth.
Yeah, not so much.
No.
With the concern over Zika virus and all, and of course past concerns over other diseases spread by mosquitoes, we've been really focusing hard on this.
Mm-hmm.
Good mosquito management starts at home. Most of our mosquito species don't fly very far, and you might be very surprised at how little water is required for our mosquito species to complete their life cycle. So one place I tell people, I mean, you can go around the yard and, of course, you know, look for places, look for all the obvious things. But one place where we find that contributes a lot to mosquito breeding are gutters. And even people with these, you know, gutter guards or shields or whatever, it's a matter if the gutters have swagged, if they've lowered a little bit through the winter. So you might think your gutters are in great shape, and turns out that in the middle there's a bit of a low spot. And, of course, with the heat up there, mosquitoes can very rapidly complete their development. Most often when people are bothered right around their homes, it is something very close at hand, and I'll tell you, gutters are, I think they're underrated for being a major contributor for mosquitoes.
I also think, too, if you're having an issue, a lot of times it's around tree lines, around the drip line of a tree. Maybe you need to thin out the tree canopy, opening that up so it can dry out. As Joe said, they like moisture. Also, if you're watering anything, making sure that you avoid watering at night for multiple reasons, but also so that there's some transpiration going on during the day with the sunlight, so that area again dries out. So just be mindful of that. Try to avoid what we call overhead irrigation. Just if you're watering something, making sure that you just focus on that root zone, it be the tree or your hydrangea or your tomato plants, but really focus on that root zone. And if there's a drainage issue, maybe a lot of compaction, maybe you need to aerate your lawn to get more oxygen in there. And so, you know, unfortunately, I can't, I don't like to suggest one remedy. You know, it's really trying to identify your environment, trying to figure out what habitat have you created for the mosquitoes.
We got an email from Randy. He wants to know if there's a good way to keep stink bugs off of ripening tomatoes.
So stink bugs are a little tricky because they have that sucking mouth part. So if you try to use an over-the-counter spray, they bypass the spray and they feed on the inside of the tissue. So a lot of our pesticides don't work. I actually like the earlier caller, or maybe it was an email, about the toads. Toads eat up to 100 insects a night. And if you create a habitat for a toad, which could be just a small aquaculture, I've used barrels, you do want to make sure with the mosquitoes, if you add a few goldfish in, it'll eat the mosquito larvae. So you don't won't have a mosquito problem. But once you create the habitat for the toad, it then has habitat and food, and it won't leave your garden. It'll start to reproduce more toads. I do the manual picking of the stink bugs, unfortunately. I feel like that's the only thing that I've found effective, especially in smaller gardens. They do sell pheromone traps, but I found in smaller gardens, pheromone traps will just bring them into your garden and not necessarily into the trap. So I think that's more of a marketing thing than it has little efficacy.
Yeah. Joe, go on.
Well, and we do need to be specific to it. I think probably the caller's referring to brown marmorated stink bugs, which, of course, is a non-native. Now, we've always had some stink bug issues with tomatoes, I mean, forever, even the native species, but not in large numbers. Brown marmorated, though, because it's a non-native, populations, just as with Japanese beetles and other non-natives, will build. And this is even worse because, you know, the main front of Japanese beetles have already passed us by. They're already out, you know, in high numbers in Illinois. We do see this cycling every so often. We're seeing this year. But we're just now experiencing the buildup of brown marmorated stink bugs. And I hate to be, a doomsdayer sounding person here, but it's probably going to get a lot worse before it gets better. Joshua, you're absolutely right. You know, hand picking, crop covers, row covers, although that's a real challenge with tomatoes.
Yeah, tomatoes are very hard.
You're right. Don't put the traps out because that just kind of has a, you know, puts an eat here sign out for them. Another little side note, though, if you have your tomatoes very close to your home, make sure you don't have a porch light on near at hand because these are attracted to lights, as many people probably have already discovered, coming to your porch light at night, and they will be attracted and find those plants and increase the problem. But in the end, I hate to say it, it's probably going to get a little bit worse before it gets better.
And I would like to add, and I think this kind of carries over to a lot of different pests, is proper garden hygiene is very important. Not giving these critters places to hide. If you keep a nice weed-free garden, it allows your soil to dry out, which will make it less likely that they'll get through to the next life cycle. It takes away their habitat, and it also opens them up to be found by predators.
Yep, and as Joe
said, I agree. I take a shower at least once a week.
Exactly.
Is that what you were talking about?
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
Oh, we've got Roger back, so let's get Roger's question in here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for all your time. My question was related to Royal Crab Apple tree. We kind of planted it 3 years back. The first year it gave excellent foliage, but since then, every time we call the person who kind of we bought it, keep saying that there is a fungal something going on and next year it should improve. But it's been 3 years and nothing is improving. So I would like to know some tips of what do we do next year.
So a lot of the cherries, they get a fungal disease on their foliage. And with any fungal disease, it's a preventative management. So if you know, especially with cherries, they're very susceptible. So it's a preventative management. So you're going to always have to spray like a copper-based fungicide, for example. And always cleaning up the leaves in the fall. So that's practicing good sanitation. If you see any oozing out of the cherry tree or if you see any blackened areas on the bark, which we call those cankers, that's not a good sign at all. Cherries, unfortunately, they're beautiful in the spring, but they are very susceptible to fungal diseases, and they are challenging to manage because it's a every 7 to 10 day spray schedule. So you also not only have to be very preventative and retroactive, you have to be very consistent. If you skip a year, if you have any of those spores overwintering and the environment allows, it will just sporulate and go to town. So again, based on your description, that's what it sounds like, and knowing that the foliar disease is very susceptible to cherries. But if you can get as we all spoke earlier about proper identification with pictures, I would love to see pictures. That would help with proper identification.
We got an email from April about apple trees she has. She says they produced apples with black spots that drop before they're picked, and she wants to know how to better care for them. Is spray necessary in this case?
So again, it sounds like a foliar disease. Again, ornamental or edible, I strongly suggest getting that identified, especially if it's edible, because there's only certain spray times that you can spray. A lot of it's at bud swell or after petal fall. So you really want to get that identified. It could be organic, but even if it's organic, you don't want to spray at time of fruit production. If this is just consumption for you, you can totally eat it, make applesauce, whatever. But of course, marketability has decreased very high. So I would avoid, selling them. But again, it's going to be a preventative spray schedule. And that's just based on your description and knowing that apples can get scab and other foliar diseases.
Well, Sarah, Joe, and Joshua, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us. Thank you. Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, Community Garden Manager with the Turner Farm Community Garden Program, Joshua Jones, an Assistant Professor in the Ohio State University Department of Entomology, and Ohio State Extension Agent for Hamilton County, Joe Boggs.